United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Margaret Bartley presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Judge Bartley, and I'm joined today via teleconference by Judge Greenberg and Judge Allen. We're here today for the matter of Mark H. Bonner versus Robert L. Wilkie, docket number 18-6927. Before us for review is the board's denial of Mr. Bonner's Q motion against a February 1976 rating decision that denied service connection for the cause of the veteran's death. Counsel for the parties, please state your name and your appearance for the record, beginning with appellant's counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. Mark Bonner on behalf of the appellant.
Thank you, Mr. Bonner. And Secretary?
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Jonathan Morris on behalf of the Secretary of Veteran Affairs.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. As you know, each party has 30 minutes to present their arguments. Mr. Bonner, how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
10 minutes, please.
Okay, thank you. We will make that happen. And Mr. Bonner, you may proceed when you're ready.
Chief Judge Bartley, and may it please the court, Judge Greenberg, Judge Allen, counsel. Veteran Emmett Bonner served in the U.S. Navy on active duty from June 1, 1935 to April 30, 1972. That's 37 years, ROA 657. He saw action in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. His untimely death from cancer on August 1, 1975 was a personal tragedy for him and a catastrophe for his wife and family. On September 9, 1975, the VA received the widow's application for DIC, ROA 20. The VA denied it on March 2, 1976 by means of a checkbox on a form, ROA 168. From August 1, 1975, when her husband died, to December 1, 1995, ROA 1509, the widow is entirely without DIC support. This is over 20 years. For widows of 08 officers like her husband who died before January 1, 1993, the rate is $2,438.74 a month. From 1995 to the present, the widow has sought DIC for the unprovided 20 years. On January 5, 2008, the widow filed a Q motion with the Board of Veterans Appeals and with the VA Regional Office, that's ROA 187. On November 2, 2018, the board denied it, ROA 3. This appeal followed. The widow died on September 30, 2010, ROA 657. The VA wrote on September 12, 2018, that we have determined that the widow's estate is the valid appeal substitute. Please add substitute Mark Bonner as the widow. That's ROA 27. Recovery in this case is destined for a small trust fund established by the widow for the support her unmarried 70-year-old daughter. Appellant's position is that the record demonstrates that the widow's 1975 claim is still open, that her claim raised and included non-Hodgkin's lymphoma as cause of death, that Emmett Bonner actually died of NHL, and that reasonable minds could not conclude otherwise. We therefore ask that the board's decision denying benefits, ROA 4, be reversed. We ask this court to compel action of the secretary unlawfully withheld and unreasonably delayed and hold unlawful and set aside the board's denial of benefits as being contrary to the widow's constitutional right of due process. I propose to order my argument in four sections. First, that the 1970 claim is still open. Number two, cause of death was in fact NHL. Three, discuss the delay and the harm it caused and continues to cause. And then I have some rebuttals prepared depending on what the secretary argues. So proceeding to the first piece of my argument that the claim is still open, the widow's 1975 claim for DIC is still open both because of Q and by application of equitable tolling. When the facts are not in dispute, equitable tolling is a matter of law. With respect to Q, the VA's failure to follow applicable law with 38 CFR 3.312 in deciding a cause of death in the 1976 rating decision constitutes Q. If the court would please look at page 14 of appellant's opening brief, where I've reproduced 3.3112. So it's on page 14 of our opening brief. There are four particular requirements in that regulation. The exercise of sound judgment, careful analysis, all facts, and particularly autopsy reports. If you compare this really excellent regulation, if you compare it with what actually was done, which is shown in ROA 1680, which I've described, I think, accurately as a hasty scribble, which was, by the way, not disclosed to the widow for 20 years, you'll see that 3.312 is not followed. Now, I haven't found that 3.312 has been judicially construed to highlight the additional burden that it places on the VA beyond the VA's usual burden of being minimally plausible. I'd ask the court, I think it would be helpful in the court's opinion were it to do so. But the court has the power to construe remedial statutes in a veteran-friendly light. Now, the harm that's caused by not doing this, other than just violating the law, is a thorough job would have included recognition of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and lymphoma as a possible diagnosis. Number two, a thorough job would have considered, or inadequate, one that just obeyed the regulation, a thorough job would have considered not only a year in Da Nang, which is up by the DMZ, and also another year offshore at Yankee Station, but also going up to Saigon with the Oklahoma City, but also the synergistic service-connected carcinogens, other ones, including what's shown on the record, H-bomb on-site participation, and exposure to the high-energy radars on guided missile warships. All three of those, had they been considered together, plausibly could have resulted in benefits being granted back then if it had been done. I move briefly for just 30 seconds onto the retroactivity argument I've made, just to explain that. The Supreme Court has developed a jurisprudence on retroactivity of some of its decisions. And the whole concept is shown in Montgomery versus Louisiana, 136 S. Court 718, 2016. This has to do when the Supreme Court finds a constitutional right. That right exists from the time it was violated. So, for example, in Gideon versus Wainwright, Gideon's right to a lawyer was actually violated years before. And the same concept is what I'm using there. We offering that as a Q violation, but 3.312 does it, and so to also do two examples of equitable tolling, which are inadequate notice for the widow to appeal and misleading her as to how her claim was treated. So the checkbox notice, box notice on page two of our reply brief, that's the expanded version. It's on page two of our reply brief. It misleads the widow into thinking that 3.312, that the VA had done a thorough job done by shipmates, by people that you could trust were looking out for you. It fails to supply reasons to appeal. Veterans are required to plead with some particularity the allegations of error. And there, what would an appeal have looked like? Well, we appeal. We don't know why. We don't like losing. But we don't know whether anything bad happened. In fact, we don't even know if anything bad happened. So it's totally inadequate to allow for any appeal. Now, with respect to the treatment of her claim for cancer, plus the evidence of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in the record in 1976, the 1996 board decision at ROA 1035. Says that the claim was cancer said the claim for cancer was only for Hodgkin's disease and didn't raise a claim for NHL. So that's where this notion is coming from, is that the board said that the RO did this. In finding the claim was only for Hodgkin's, all this, it was in the context of not even asking or telling the widow what the VA was doing and suppressing any ability really to appeal. The appeal could have clarified.
Mr. Bonner, this is Judge Bartley. I understand the issue that you're arguing right now, but Why isn't that argument foreclosed by our decision in the Federal Circuit's prior decision in your case or your mother's case?
Okay.
Hasn't it already been determined finally that the claim didn't encompass NHL?
Yes, I have this with respect to that, Chief Judge, and that would be really issue preclusion, also known as collateral estoppel, which I believe does not apply here. I'll tell you why. I think that at least. The cause of death was not first. There were two issues, cause of death and whether the claim was sufficient. The cause of death, according to the Federal Circuit, was not relied on or decided by the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. So apparently the court found what Judge Hagel basically said, that it didn't need to reach that. But anyway, issue preclusion was not raised by the board. The board didn't raise issue preclusion. I'd cite Moore's Federal Practice 132.01.4d says that collateral estoppel would be what I think we're talking about with respect to this issue. It's an equitable doctrine that should be applied only when the alignment of the parties in the legal issue and the factual issues raised warrant it. And right there, Moore cites a Second Circuit case, CBF Industries, 2017. Because issue preclusion is an equitable doctrine, the litigant who invokes it must have clean hands, and the court will not apply issue preclusion in favor of one who acted fraudulently or has by deceit or other means gained unfair advantage in the previous tribunal. I have an argument for that later on, that the arguments that the NIH diagnosis was substituting the indefinite article A for the word the where the NIH says the diagnosis. They have a particular diagnosis, yet the VA has been pushing the notion that it says A, and in fact even quotes it as saying A, making it indefinite. So I don't think that's entirely clean hands. I have more on that later. But also Wright Federal Practice and Procedure, Section 8255, says that the Supreme Court in an action involving two court actions observed that unfairness would result in collateral effect if there are procedural opportunities available that are unavailable in the first action of a kind that might be likely to cause a different result. The Supreme Court in B&B Hardware versus Hargis Industries, 135 S Court, 1293, 2015, states that this issue of collateral estoppel is a fundamental fairness inquiry. The argument on collateral estoppel wasn't raised, I submit, by the board or indeed by the secretary, but it's a post hoc argument, so it's not raised or relied on by the board. I say it's waived by the board. It's not even cited by the board, your opinion, a CAVC or the Fed Circuit opinion, not even cited by the board. The CAVC did not say the claim did not raise NHL, just that it couldn't conclude that it did. And Judge Hagel says that the case is such that the court need not reach the issue of whether Mrs. Bonner's claim in her 1975 DIC application included a claim for NHL. So in other words, basically that's saying that it was dicta, must suggest that the court adopt that. I'll give you two more pieces of this. The government didn't raise it, of course. They spoke of binding precedent, which is different from collateral estoppel. They raised it only for a half a page in their brief. The last piece is this. I'd ask the court to, if you have the Federal Circuit opinion ready to hand, if you look at 497 Fed 3rd at 1325 Note 1, now, this is a little out of order for my argument, but I'm going to parse out. As a matter of fact, the government's brief we have reproduced in it what the NIH actually says. Let me find that. Here it is on page 9. If you take a look at page 9 of the government's opening, excuse me, the government. I'm not the government anymore. The appellant's opening brief. And compare that with the Federal Circuit's opinion Judge Archer for the court on page 1325, note 1. You see, the NIH says in their note, immunohistochemical studies favor the diagnosis of non-Hodgkin's. Now, the VA has been advancing an erroneous argument that somehow this is uncertain. And one way that has happened is they have been repeatedly saying, they say it even in the briefs now before this court, they quote that as saying favor the diagnosis. They say it favors a diagnosis. The is a definite article. A is an indefinite article. So by substituting those words out, by changing that to say a diagnosis, it makes it uncertain. And they scored with this, unfortunately, with the Federal Circuit opinion. This goes to my unclean hands or lack of clean hands. I'm not complaining about anybody, just raising it for the court. Take a look at note one. The court there says quotes, favored a diagnosis of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, purporting to quote what the NIH says. Now, where did Judge Archer got that? He got the arguments of the VA, right? The opinion gets it right if you go up from that footnote into the body of the text. It's quoted properly. But when the court is responding to the dissent's argument, I suppose did it from memory, and having been essentially led astray by arguments of the VA. So that's my response to the issue preclusion argument, Chief Judge. May I proceed? Am I still on the call? Oh, Lord. Am I still here?
You're still here. This is Judge Greenberg.
You're still on.
Yeah.
Okay, you're still on.
Okay. May I ask a question, Chief?
Yes, go ahead, Judge Greenberg.
This is Judge Greenberg, Mr. Bonner. To put it another way, your mother had clean hands, A, and B, another equitable maxim is that she was not dilatory or slow in making her application. Is that correct?
Absolutely, Judge Greenberg. And I'd add to that this concept of equitable estoppel, I can see it having a place in veterans law, but only if the person arguing against it has abused it. So if a person, like writ writers for writing habeas corpus petitions, would write hundreds of them, after a while the court has to shut it down. So I can see if a person kept recycling his case through court, after a while it would apply. But in veteran-friendly veterans law, I think it should be applied sparingly and only when the equities really call for it. And I don't think – I submit the equities here are all on behalf of the widow and definitely not in favor of the VA.
Well, let me ask you this. What would be wrong with our court in the context presented here with adopting Judge Newman's dissent, her approach, and taking a fresh look at the statute, the Q statute, and concluding that as a matter of law, the result you seek is appropriate?
It sounds accurate to me, Your Honor. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Thank you.
With respect to the claim being still open, they're talking about equitable estoppel. The 3.312 argument, we did that. So, okay, the checkbox notice is the other way that the opinion, the case is still open. It misleads the widow into thinking, by the way, it shows up on page 2 of our reply brief. It misleads the widow by giving her inadequate opportunity to appeal. I've actually mentioned that. Excuse me. So if I could talk about cause of death, I think I might ask for an extra minute or two. But with respect to cause of death, there's the one thing I've actually already spoken to it a little bit. If you look at the government's brief on the appellant's brief on page 9, you'll see that The diagnosis says it's simulating, and the VA has made a lot of about the word simulating. Black's Law Dictionary defines simulated fact as a fabricated fact intended to mislead, a lie. So I don't think simulate helps the VA at all. Number two, and I mentioned the definite versus indefinite article, they're switching them out, totally changes the content. Last piece for that is, you'll see that one of the diagnoses is large cell immunoblastic type lymphoma, right? And I can say that large cell immunoblastic lymphoma is defined in Dorland's as, quote, a type of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. This is it's called medical text evidence. So it's flat out defined as a type of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. The board cites Dorland's, but didn't look up large cell immunoblastic lymphoma.
Mr. Bonner, just to clarify, the large cell immunoblastic type, that comes from the 1995 report, or is that from the earlier autopsy autopsy protocol?
It comes right off of the NIH report, Your Honor.
Dated 1995.
Yes.
Dated June 19, 1995.
Right. That was ascertained when Admiral. Thank you, when Admiral Bonner.
Please add another 5 minutes.
Thank you. When Admiral Bonner died, his body was autopsied at the National Naval Medical Center, and they took pieces, little tissue samples, and hung onto them. They gave those tissue samples from his body to NIH to examine. So they were examined in 1995, but they were from his 1975 demise. A last piece would be to look at ROA 153, which is the next page. It's in the NIH diagnosis. And they do an unadorned version of their diagnosis there on ROA 153. Final anatomic diagnosis, malignant lymphoma, large cell immunoblastic type, which is what Dorland's defines as being a type of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So the only way a person could accept the notion that the NIH diagnosis of NHL is uncertain is to do so based not on the contents of the NIH document itself, but rather on what others have said it says. So the last piece of this is that finally I'd point out that even though we've shown it, we don't have to show that Admiral Bonner did not have Hodgkin's. Nor do we have to show that he died of NHL. All we have to show is that he had NHL. The NIH's National Cancer Institute says you can have both at the same time, even in the same organs, called composite lymphoma. So the board erred in finding that a reasonably prudent person would not have considered whether service connection for NHL was warranted. All of this problem came from two board RO decisions.
Mr. Bonner, this is Judge Bartley. Are you arguing that in 1975, VA adjudicators should have independently made medical conclusions about the autopsy findings?
No, I'm not. I'm sorry, in what year, 1975?
Yes, because you're claiming against the 1975 decision.
Yeah, 1975 decision is still open because of Q and because of equitable tolling. And
that's what we're here to decide. But my question was, are you arguing that in 1975 VA adjudicators should have independently made some medical conclusions about the autopsy report?
They should have treated her claim as a claim for NHL as well, because it was. Therefore, when she, because of the retroactive statute that were passed in the 1990s, when the claim was submitted then, it would have been granted. So
thank you.
You're welcome. There are two ROA sites I want to give to you. I refer to a rating decision code sheet in my brief, and that's at ROA 1523. And I do remark that the VA went from a negligent to a reckless decision that is totally unfounded. Well, the reckless decision of 1027-97 is at ROA 1363. It's a statement of the case where the VA said NIH evidence is negative for a diagnosis of NHL. Just flat wrong. And they got worse. On 8-13-99, ROA 1129, they doubled down, saying the NIH report is negative for evidence confirming that the disease was ever reclassified to provide for a definitive diagnosis of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. That's just recklessly wrong. So I think I've used up my 5 minutes. I have a conversation about delay and some other things, but only if the court will allow me.
Thank you, Mr. Bonner. Judge Greenberg, do you have any further questions?
Not at this time, but I'll wait for Mr. Bonner on his rebuttal to deal with the issues that he's just mentioned.
And Judge Allen, do you have any questions?
I don't, Chief. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bonner. Mr. Morris, you may proceed when ready.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Your Honors, there are three reasons why the Court should affirm the Board's decision on appeal. First, neither party is disputing that in September 1975, the veteran's surviving spouse filed a claim for cause of death due to cancer and that she submitted two pieces of evidence which both identify Hodgkin's disease as the cause of death. Second, in a 2005 decision, this court previously addressed the pertinent legal issues and facts in this case, indicating that the evidence at the time of the final RO adjudication did not reasonably raise any claims for cause of death by types of cancer other than Hodgkin's disease, and that 38 CFR Section 3.313 would not enable appellant to receive an effective date earlier than November 1, 1994. Finally, despite repackaging arguments made previously before this court under the framework of Q, appellant has failed to meet the high legal standard to establish that kind of rare error in a final RO decision. To get started,
Mr. Morris, could I jump in? I'm sorry. It's early. This is Judge Allen, but I do have a question. You refer to, and there was a great deal of argument in Mr. Bonner's first portion with respect to the earlier decision of this court and then following on the Federal Circuit. And what is your understanding if, in fact, those decisions in combination essentially foreclose this because, as you put it, it's repackaged arguments? What then was the Federal Circuit thinking by specifically saying, hey, you can raise a Q motion about this? If, in fact, all of that resolved what we're doing today over a decade later, what possible purpose would have been the Federal Circuit's statement about filing a Q motion? I'm really struggling with what that means.
Well, Your Honor, from our interpretation of the previous decision, the previous appeal stream would have been covering earlier effective date, utilizing the guidelines under how, you know, VA assigns traditional effective dates, looking at the liberalizing law provisions in awarding a year prior to a date of claim if the claim was filed within was filed after the date of the liberalizing law and what have you, with the actual arguments that were at the time that appeared to be alleging, clear and unmistakable error or just error at the time the original decision was made, which is, again, the argument appears to be a misunderstanding of what the framework of Q is, but by utilizing layman's terms such as error at the time of the decision and things like that. My impression is that the Federal Circuit was highlighting that what needed to be filed and what needed to be addressed to negate the finality of the February 1976 rating decision would be to actually get under that framework of Q rather than in the framework of an earlier effective date. So to this point, again, you know, the court has already acknowledged that the 1975 claim was not so expansive, explicitly stating in its 2005 precedential decision that at the time of the 1976 RO adjudication, the evidence established that Mrs. Bonner's claim was one for Hodgkin's disease as the cause of her husband's death, and therefore the court cannot conclude that the evidence reasonably raised any claims for the cause of death by types of cancer other than Hodgkin's disease. As noted, this finding was affirmed by the Federal Circuit in 2007, and the board again made the same factual finding in the decision on appeal. This determination comports with the law, which dictates that VA sympathetically read a claim and is guided not just by the four corners of the document, but also the supporting evidence submitted. Because the evidence submitted only diagnosed Hodgkin's disease, the fact that the final February 1976 rating decision only needed to address and only denied entitlement to service connection for cause of the veteran's death based on the cancer diagnosed, Hodgkin's disease, it is not and cannot be in dispute. Fundamentally, even a liberal reading of the original claim for DIC would not have resulted in a grant of benefits for any other cancer diagnosis to include non-Hodgkin's lymphoma because no other type of cancer aside from Hodgkin's disease was diagnosed at the time of the final 1976 adjudication. To the extent that appellant is attempting to rely on a June 1995 report from the NIH to argue that the death certificate and autopsy report that were submitted in 1975 clearly reflect that the cause of the veteran's death was incorrect, there are a few issues with this argument. First, the June 1995 NIH report is not a clear diagnosis of NHL and clear assertion of misdiagnosis in 1975. Contrary to appellant's argument a few minutes ago, the majority in the Federal Circuit's opinion specifically indicated that Admiral Bonner's condition at the time of his death was ambiguous, in that his illness simulated Hodgkin's disease, but also favored a diagnosis of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. This would have been at the Federal Circuit opinion at 1325. Second, even if the report did establish that the veteran was misdiagnosed in 1975, this court has indicated on several occasions that a medical examiner's misdiagnosis is not Q. Likewise, this court has found that advances in medicine or changes in medical knowledge cannot be used as the basis of Q. The rationale behind these notions is that medical personnel are not adjudicators, and as such, they cannot commit Q. And again, significantly, the board addressed this argument and properly found that a misdiagnosis cannot equal Q. That was R at 10. Third, to the extent appellant suggests that the June 1995 NIH report makes it clear that it was so obvious that there was a misdiagnosis such that the RO in 1976 should have sought a second opinion, this amounts to a duty to assist error, which the law also makes clear cannot constitute Q. That's going to be Cook v. Principe as well as Caffrey versus Brown. And finally, a 1995 report could not have and did not exist in 1976. For that reason, it cannot constitute Q. Again, that's what the board found R at 10. Therefore, appellant failed to demonstrate that the record that existed at the time of the final 1976 RO decision demonstrates Q in that decision. As well, his arguments failed to demonstrate that there was a pending unadjudicated claim, again, something that this court already recognized and addressed in 2005. In the same way, appellant fails to demonstrate how a subsequently promulgated regulation can serve to support a finding of clear and unmistakable error in a final rating decision. First, it is undisputed that 38 CFR Section 3.313 did not exist in 1975. It was enacted in October 1990. Nor did the liberalizing law in 3.309E, the presumption of service connection for Hodgkin's disease, exist in 1975. It was promulgated in February 1994. This court has previously found that a determination that was a clear and unmistakable error must be based on the record and the law that existed at the time of the prior AOJ or BVA decision. Similarly,
Mr. Morris, have we ever undertaken to review whether that holding that you just mentioned would also apply where there was a retroactive effective date of a regulation? Have we addressed that previously?
Your Honor, I don't think I understand your question. Has appellant?
No, has the court addressed that issue? You're saying that the two have to be based on the, you know, record as it existed at the time, but have we had a case that involved a regulation with a retroactive effective date in a Q context?
In a Q context, not to our knowledge. But again, insofar as appellant attempts to rely on that retroactive effective date of 3.313, this regulation was not in existence at the time of the final 1976 rating decision pursuant to Cook. More importantly, the veteran did not have
but it does have a retroactive effective date, meaning that it was to take effect back in the mid to early 60s, I believe.
Correct.
So kind of following that up, it would have been of record then. We could possibly consider it to have been of record in 76 if it took effect in the early 1960s.
Sure. So the effective date was brought back to August of 1965. You're sort of the beginning of the Vietnam era. But again, the main issue here is that, as the general counsel opinion of May 1994 makes clear, the veteran would have needed to be otherwise eligible, on the date of claim sort of to potentially get that effective date. And again, the veteran was not eligible for entitlement to service connection for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma for several reasons. One, he didn't have a diagnosis of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, nor was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma adjudicated at that time. So to the extent that appellant is attempting to use, 3.313 to bypass the legal requirements of Q, that argument fails. As the court found in 2005, because the veteran's surviving spouse did not file her informal claim until more than 1 year after the liberalizing law, in this particular case, it was 3.309E, the presumption for Hodgkin's disease, was enacted in February 1995. The earliest possible effective date available would have been November 1, 1994, which was the date that was awarded. Once again, the standard for proving clear and unmistakable error is a high one, which appellant has failed to meet. Lastly, getting to the argument that was made by appellant in his opening presentation with respect to notice, on March 8th, 1976, VA sent the original appellant a letter notifying her of the denial of her DIC claim and informing her of her appellate rights. That's R 1644 and 6 to 1645. This is not just a checkbox form. And if you look at R 168, that's a date stamp that indicates that appellant sent in to VA in 2015 of the original rating decision that the surviving spouse received back in 1976. So not only was the original appellant mailed a copy of the rating decision, R 1670 as well as a notice letter explicitly informing her of the denial of DIC benefits and for appellate rights, again, that's 1644-65. These documents clearly informed appellants of her DIC claim was being denied and of her appellate rights. And again, the board found that she was properly informed, and that would have been RF-7. So this is a court of law, and the standard for proving Q is higher than the standard to grant entitlement to an earlier effective date on direct appeal in a non-Q context. In Russell, this court stated that a clear and unmistakable error is undebatable, so that it can be said that reasonable minds could only conclude that the original decision was fatally flawed at the time it was made. No matter how compelling the facts are in this particular case, appellant cannot prevail based on the submission of evidence of an ambiguous misdiagnosis or changed diagnosis 20 years after a final RO adjudication, nor on law that was enacted 14 years after the final RO adjudication, as this court and the Federal Circuit both make clear in numerous precedential decisions such as Russell, Henry, and Cook. For these reasons, this court should affirm the board's decision on appeal and hold that the board's determination that there was no Q in the final February 1976 rating decision was not arbitrary, capricious, an abuse of discretion, or otherwise not in accordance with law, and that the board's decision was supported by an adequate statement of reasons or basis. If there are no further questions, then the secretary respectfully requests that the court affirm the board's decision on appeal.
Judge Greenberg, do you have any questions?
No.
Judge Allen, do you have any further questions?
I don't. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Morris. Mr. Bonner, you may proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The appellant's position is that if the claim is still open and if non-Hodgkin's lymphoma was established in the NIH diagnosis, then the board denying benefits is in error if the 1975 claim raised NHL, not that the 1975 claim conclusively proved it. All right, so that's our position. With respect to the 1975 claim, yes, there was no diagnosis of diagnosis of Hodgkin's. There was the certificate said so, but the board erred there in not applying 3.312. It's supposed to look at the autopsy reports as well, and they didn't do it. With respect to the delay in this case, it would have been
Mr. Bonner, as to what you just said, the Secretary's counsel was arguing that that would have any violation of the precepts of 3.312 would have been a duty to assist error. What is your response to that?
That's not duty to assist. It's a regulation that requires them to do it. So I don't think it's a duty to assist at all. It's a duty to follow a regulation binding on the Secretary. It has nothing to do with assisting the claimant, and it has to do with the Secretary's duty towards a claimant.
Thank you.
A couple of thoughts, please, with respect to a delay here. Certainly there would have been the fact it wasn't adjudicated in 1975 as we would like to have had it, because the Secretary misled the widow and didn't give her information necessary to appeal. If they hadn't done that, nonfeasance, if you please, there would have been an appeal. We found out what happened when somebody looked at it with a fair look. The Department of Justice got this, and they're not the Department of Fairness, you know. Yet they recognized from looking at the autopsy report that something needed to be done. That would have happened back in 1976 if the VA hadn't hidden the ball. With respect to delay, I would point this out. There's an eight-year delay injected by VA. The following. All right. We filed our Q petition with the board and with the RO, ROA 187, on June 5th, 2008. All right. The widow died on September 30th, 2010. On October the 6th, 2010, ROA 657, the VA records notice, having received it from the widow's executor. So they record notice that they're on notice of her death, and they made a record of it. October the 11th, VA, 2010, ROA 650, the VA sent a letter to the estate of the widow cutting off her benefits and acknowledging that the widow had died. The next day, the VA, the ROA, issued their statement of the case denying benefits that took years. So they issued this without hastily, curiously, 6 days after they're notified that she's dead, a statement of the case has been sitting for over a year at the VA, gets sent out. And what happened there is on August the 6th, 2012, several years later, ROA 550, the board advanced the case for the now 2 years dead widow on their docket. And on August 30th, 2012, the board sent it back. Returns the file to the RO because it was defective for not having recognized taking action because of her death. That reposed there for over 1,000 days and was dislodged by July 24, 2015, ROA 196, mandamus petition, which was mooted by, as usual, by VA action. Now, in August, and then November 2, 2018, we got the board decision that we've appealed. From the filing of the Q motion, June 5, 2008, to the board decision of November 2, 2018 is more than 10 years. And from the October 12, 2010, RO shenanigans, ROA 636, to the November 2, 2018 board decision, here appeal is more than 8 years. So the harm caused by this, this kind of action and lack of paying DIC is lack of current support for the first 20 years of this widow's widowhood. She suffers a substantial loss of support, which is not backstopped by the VA. It creates uncertainty of future support, denial of the use of the DIC funds for living, denial of any opportunity to gather interest on it, causation of necessity of borrowing money. It creates emotional, social, and financial damage every day. Secretary has a duty to pay DIC, and people rely on it. If the VA needs a delay, there should be a compelling reason. Here the issues are not hard. The claim is clear and adequate. The cause of death is beyond rational dispute. The Veterans Service clearly shows he earned it, and the widow was clearly entitled to it. So there's no excuse for the VA's phenomenal delay in this case. There are no market forces at work here. The Secretary has demonstrated a limitless tolerance for delay. 50 to 100 years is not too much. The only remedy is for this honorable court to exercise its authority that the American people have through Congress given it for the welfare of veterans and their families.
Mr. Bonner,
yes.
this is Judge Greenberg. Would it be fair to say that we could rule in your favor either as a matter of constitutional dimension, which you began your argument with, I believe, statutory construction with regard to the Q statute, and or the misapplication of the veteran-friendly regulation, all three or any one of them? Is that your argument?
It is, Your Honor. We're asking this honorable court to reverse the board and find that the claim is still open because of equitable estoppel and Q. May I continue?
Yes.
Yes.
Right. Okay. The record is well developed and reasonable minds cannot reasonably differ that the 1975 claim and autopsy report are sufficient to claim NHL as cause of death. The 1995 NIH report established that NHL was the cause of death or contributory cause of death. And therefore, he asked the court to order the secretary to pay DIC from the 1975 date of the claim to 1995 when DIC commenced, but also asked the court to construe 3.312 and under 38 U.S. Code 7261, compel action by the secretary unreasonably withheld, unlawfully withheld and unreasonably delayed and hold unlawful and set aside the board's decision not to award DIC as contrary to the widow's constitutional right to due process. The time reasonably available for a remand has been used up by the secretary already, and for no good reason. He is already well beyond statutory unreasonable delay and well into a due process violation. A remand would just enable the secretary to prolong the violation. There's more than enough evidence here for the board to have awarded benefits. Board's decision to deny them is just an exercise of naked and arbitrary power. So in conclusion, the VA actions can be good, and they're affirmed. They can be bad, they get remanded. They can be ugly, and they should be reversed. So we respectfully ask this honorable court to reverse the board's decision denying benefits and order the secretary to pay. Thank you.
Judge Greenberg, do you have any further questions?
No, I haven't. Thank you.
And Judge Allen, do you have questions?
I don't, Chief. Thanks.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Bonner.
Thank you.
And we thank both parties very much for their arguments. The case is submitted for consideration.
The court is in recess.